We have met, yes, welcome. You've had a number of roles in your life, not just my father, and Marie's brother as well, and Celia's father, and you've worked for Laidlaw College, and you were the Dean of Studies there for a while, and then you were the Senior Lecturer, is that correct? What are you interested in studying and thinking about these days? Because I know recently you did a sermon at St. Aidan's Anglican Church about aliens, is that correct?
Oh, aliens, yes. Yes, among other things. Yes, there are a number of things that I research and speak about. And the question of extraterrestrial life, that's an interesting topic. So, Peter, I could come and enlighten people here if need be.
Yeah. So what are some of the other subjects that you're interested in, apart from the Syrophoenician woman?
Basically, the unique place that Christ has both in our own lives and in the world of religions. So trying to get the balance right between respecting people of other beliefs and yet holding firmly to what makes us Christian, which is Christ. How do you get the balance right there without bad-mouthing other people or going all sentimental and naive about the religion? So holding that balance together. So I shouldn't say it, but my latest book on the topic comes out on the first of December.
You go ahead and say it, because that's my No, you go ahead and say it.
Well, that's what's going to happen. Yes.
Right. So. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to leave this with you.
So, Lizzie, if you could just pivot the screen, that little screen, and point it towards me a bit. We've got the light off there. And Deborah, I think I just pressed this red button now. Indeed. Oh, it's done. There it is. Jewish dialogue and humour are different, even in front of a Gentile audience. So I'm at a conference in the States with the world's leading biblical scholars. And I'm going back to it in November this year. And when I can, I try to go along to sessions that are presented by Jewish presenters, because these are feisty events, especially when you get, as this particular story relates to, two rabbis on one side of an argument, two rabbis on the other side of the argument, talking about the book of Job. And honestly, I thought they would start punching one another. It was so, until one of them says, look, we can settle this with a story. And so he says to us, and this is the point about Jewish humor being just a little bit different. There's a, it relates to the American army, and there's a young, as they say, lieutenant, who summons to his commanding officer, and lieutenant, there's something for you to do here. One of the men in your platoon, both his parents have been killed in a car accident. You need to go and tell him. Off you go. Oh, by the way, he's Jewish. Off you go. So this poor young lieutenant has to break this news to this young Jewish soldier. He's wondering, how am I going to do this? As he's walking back to the barracks, he suddenly remembers the sergeant for the platoon is Jewish. He thinks he'll know what to do. He gets the sergeant. Sergeant says, it's easy. There's no problem at all here. So the sergeant gets all 30 guys out of the barracks, lines up in a straight line, and says, listen up, you guys. Any of you who have both parents still alive, take a step forward. What do you think you're doing, Goldstein? Yes. Now, what pleased me was that everyone in the audience laughed, especially I'm looking around thinking, is this really funny? But I noticed that all the Jewish people who are there in this audience all think this is very funny. Just a little reminder that other cultures, particularly if you hear them say so, give permission to exercise humour in a different way to the way that we rather sensitive Anglo-Saxons exercise it. So that's going to be a bit of a lead-in to the story today, because we're going back over the story that Lizzie read. Well, you can see it all there, Jesus in the region of Tyre. Just run your eye down it. There's a woman whose daughter has an unclean spirit. She's Greek Syrophoenician. And he says to her, let the children be satisfied first. Not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And she answers, and you realize the story goes on, even the dogs eat some of the children's crumbs. Jesus says to her, because you said this, you may go. Spirits left your daughter. She goes home and finds the child lying on the bed and the spirit gone. Well, that's the story that we're going to be looking at. Now, it's a story that has attracted a lot of attention. For example, in feminist biblical interpretation, the same story is used either to make the point that this poor, oppressed, Tangata Whenua woman is dealt to by an arrogant Jewish male, or the very opposite point, that this arrogant Jewish male receives his comeuppance from a feisty, witty local woman. Sort of the opposite way of looking at it, and a whole lot of other interpretations are attached to it. It's a great story for dividing opinion. Well, let's get into it a little bit. It takes place to the northwest of Galilee. You can see on the map there, you've got Galilee where Jesus spends almost all of his time. But he takes this northwestern journey up into the region of Phoenicia, Tyre, you can see there, and a little bit further up the coast, the other seaport of Sidon. And about this place, we know, for example, just to give you one example of why this story is interesting, we know that a century later, when the Jewish rabbis have got over the destruction of Jerusalem, they draw up a map of places where pious Jews, having been expelled from Jerusalem, are not allowed to go. They're not allowed to settle in a number of places because they are so notoriously anti-Jewish and pagan, and Tyre and Sidon are specifically named. But here Jesus goes off because he needs a break and he knows he's not going to be harassed by fellow Jews if he's up there. Just a little bit of the historical background there. In terms of artwork, just trying to get visually to get the picture in our minds, there's quite a lot of artwork associated with this story. This one's not too bad. There's the Syrophoenician woman kneeling, as the story says. Jesus doesn't have to be in white robes, but there he is. Can you see down the bottom right of the picture, can you just make out what kind of animal? Dogs, yes. So the dogs are there, reminding us of what's going on. I'll come to some other artwork later. That's about as good as you're going to get in terms of sort of fairly recent attempts to picture it. Before, though, we think that this woman is simply an oppressed local peasant woman. We have only one example of art that pictures a Syrophoenician woman. So just look at it for a moment. If this is accurate, and from what I gather it is, this Syrophoenician woman, pretty smart looking woman, wouldn't you think? Got a certain look in her eye. I think I'm going to try to steer the story away from this is just a poor Canaanite peasant woman, and this piece of artwork maybe adds another angle to our understanding of the story. Okay, so here's the story again. So I've just underlined a few things here. So he goes to the region of Tyre, I've told you a bit about that. The woman clearly is in need, she falls at his feet. She's Greek, Syrophoenician, Greek meaning she's Greek speaking. And living in this area of Syrophoenicia, a combination of what we'd say Syrian and Greek-derived Phoenician or Greek-speaking. And of course, interesting to think about what language the discussion happens in between Jesus and this woman. It's almost certainly a mixture of Aramaic that both Jesus and the woman would know, and Greek, because there's strong evidence that Jesus speaks Greek as well, or at least enough Greek and enough Aramaic for the two of them to have this kind of dialogue. The story then moves on to children, children's bread, and dogs. Dogs under the table. And the story ends in the happy way that we see there. Okay, so what are we going to make of this story? Well, a number of possibilities. Here's the headlines in the local Times. The Christ insults Canaanite. Or to see the story co-opted in another way, Black Lives Matter. Here's a recent poster from the Black Lives Matter campaign. Jesus understood justice more deeply because he insisted that Syrophoenician lives matter. So again, you're seeing the story divided. Is it an insulting story? Is it in fact Jesus is a proto-feminist? What actually is this story trying to tell us today? Maybe all of those things, maybe bits of those things. Well, let's try to look a little more detail. But before we even do that, why should we even be looking at this story? Is it accurate? Is it just a piece of propaganda for some perhaps strange reason that we don't quite gather? So is this an authentic story? So what do I, as a biblical scholar, think about? Can we trust this story? Is it true? Well, I think there are good reasons to trust this story. It's geographically precise in a way that if you were making up the story somewhere else, you wouldn't know these details about Tyre and Sidon and Greeks and Syrophoenician culture. Culturally, it's right on the mark. It knows exactly where the cultural issues lie, and one of them we'll come back to in a moment. It's ethnically very precise. We're going to compare this story with the parallel account in Matthew and realize that there are a number of places where if you invented this story, you might wobble, you might not get it right. In all those accounts, the story does get it right because we know quite a lot about this particular region. And another reason why this story isn't invented is because if you are busy inventing some propaganda for the Christian cause, when you think about it, this story is not something you ought to have included. It's actually an embarrassing story in many ways. Jesus offers a sensational put-down to this poor woman. He seems to be racist. He seems to be patriarchal. If you're inventing a story trying to commend Christianity to a lot of outside people, you wouldn't invent an embarrassing story like this. Gentiles, for example, wouldn't like the rudeness that Jesus displays. And interestingly enough, Luke, when he goes to tell the story of Jesus, leaves this story out. Luke knows what goes before this story. I'm going to show you in a moment that Mark and Matthew have a very interesting thing to say, and Luke says it as well. Matthew and Mark then illustrate what they're saying with the story. Luke, who's aiming at Gentiles, leaves this story out. Too hot to handle. I think that's just a human factor that we see in the Gospels. Gentiles wouldn't like Jesus' rudeness, and Jewish readers too are going to be a bit upset by this story. Here's Jesus having public dialogue with a woman. A very strong rabbinic injunction from that time, which had lasted over the centuries, is Jewish males do not talk to women in public who are not their own kin. And yet Jesus is doing it all the time. That would make Jews uneasy. He's interacting not only in public with a woman, but a woman who's a Gentile as well. That makes it even worse. Jesus is breaking purity and dietary and gender norms by even associating with people like this. I mean, he's gone into Tyre and Sidon. He's got to eat there. You can't get kosher food up there. What's he going to eat? And he's in a Gentile house. You can't do that. It's forbidden for Jews to go even into. Gentile houses. Jesus, so the story's not a good one for trying to commend the gospel to Jews either. But there's freedom for Mark and Matthew as writers to tell the story, and to tell it a little bit differently, which is another reason to realize that the story is not invented. They're not just slavishly copying. They actually make some changes in the story. Each of them has the freedom as an editor. So it just adds to the authenticity. So I'm sorry to just rabbit on about that, but I think it's important that we be able to trust these stories as authentic. So we've heard the story from Mark 7, that's on the left-hand side there. Matthew, when he tells the same story, just adds a few things, just to make it clear to his Jewish reader. He rubs it in a little bit. It's not just Tyre, it's the region of Tyre and Sidon, and we'll come back to the importance of that. Matthew calls the woman a Canaanite woman. You know the Canaanites, the tongue of Phanuel, that the Jews had dealt to very badly. He actually takes a deep breath and says she's actually Canaanite. She comes crying out to him. She makes a public display. That's a bit of a risk too. You know, when you take this story and you go into Middle Eastern villages today in North Africa and other parts of the Western Mediterranean and say, here's a woman, middle of the day, no males around her, yelling out in the street and rushing up to male strangers, what would her job be? You say, oh, every villager in the Middle East today says, prostitute. Pretty obvious. Only people who do this are prostitutes, act in this kind of way. There's another risk that Matthew takes by adding this little detail to his story. She's crying out. She obviously has some knowledge of the Jewish background. How does she know he's Jewish? Obvious, just looks at his clothes. I mean, in the Middle East, that's what people do, particularly in those days. You could tell people's ethnicity just by looking at their clothes. So she knows he's Jewish. So she thinks he must be someone important. He's come all this way. That's why she cries out in the way that she does. And Matthew points out some other things. Notice there how Jesus reacts. We wouldn't know this from Mark. Jesus ignores the woman. She's persistently calling out to him. He answers her with silence. His disciples are uneasy by what's going on. Disciples say, send her away. She keeps on crying out after us. And then the story unfolds in the way that we know. And down there in verse 28, woman, you have great faith. Matthew adds that. It's sort of implied by Mark, but not Matthew. So what I'm saying is, compare these two stories, they become even richer in the detail that is found there. Okay, so the story is obviously important. You've been going through Mark's gospel, I know. And it's important for a number of reasons. For example, no one else in Mark is identified and described so clearly. That there are four markers. So sometimes in Mark will give a name, but he doesn't give the four specific details to make sure we really understand who this woman is. So clearly Mark goes to some trouble, or Mark and Matthew, they go to some trouble to carefully identify the woman. And just one last thing, just trying to get us into this story. I mentioned to you, but before we have this story in both Matthew and Mark, and it would have been in Luke if Luke could bring himself to tell the story, but he can't. But in Matthew and Mark, you have this passage about the Pharisees and scribes noticing that Jesus' disciples eat bread with unclean, that is, unwashed hands. They don't go through the Jewish purification thing before eating. Now, we're not talking about health hygiene here. We're talking about ritual kind of stuff here. And says, you know, why are your disciples breaking Jewish law in this way? Verse 15, Jesus says, nothing that goes into a person from outside can defile them. I thought Jesus was Jewish. How can he say this? This completely breaks with Torah. Nothing that goes into a person from outside can defile them. It's what comes from within. And the same in Matthew 15. Now, why is this important? Because here's Jesus clearly breaking with Jewish precedent, and then immediately in Matthew and Mark, he goes off to this pagan Gentile territory and consolidates this breaking of Torah and adds a few more things to it as well. So that's why the story is has this background to it. So just keep that in mind too as we try to understand the story. Okay, this is a story about faith and humility that has a number of quite poignant and moving dimensions to it. For example, the irony. Jesus constantly rebukes his own disciples, hand-chosen Jewish disciples. He has to rebuke them often for their lack of faith. And yet this is a stunning story of someone who displays the kind of faith and humility that Jesus attaches great importance to. And who displays it? A pagan, Gentile woman who has some other negative features as well from a Jewish point of view. Think about the person displaying this faith. Think about where she lives. Either you call it Tyre, and the Jewish historian Josephus, he sums up Tyre. The people who live there are notoriously our bitterest enemies. This is Josephus writing at the time of Jesus. Who lives in Tyre? Our bitterest enemies. And here one of them is going to show faith that really moves Jesus. Matthew adds in Sidon, because he wants to remind his Jewish readers that this is where the feared Jezebel comes from. So you put the two together, Tyre and Sidon. What is a Jew doing up there? And meeting someone who displays the kind of faith that not only his hand-picked disciples display. Her race is Canaanite. Again, we know just from the whole of the Old Testament that the Canaanites were bitter enemies. An average Jewish reader is going to evoke fear and revulsion. And her social standing. Now, here's an interesting thing that's only recently become apparent to particularly to the social scientists who look at this story. We often think, and the artwork often shows the woman as sort of poor and depressed and desperate and out of her mind or whatever. But actually, we know that these Syrophoenicians, socially speaking, constituted a wealthy upper class. And moreover, they are known as exploiters of rural Jews. Now, Jesus comes from Galilee. Jesus is constantly associating with peasants, rural Jews, all of whom are being, unfortunately, exploited. The people they sell their produce to, for example, those who own the land round about them, an increasing number of them are going to be Syrophoenicians. This woman and the piece of artwork that I showed you, I think I've got it coming up next, here's an example. A wealthy, upper-class oppressor of rural Jewish people. No wonder the disciples are uneasy. This is not a woman we should be associating with. Now, if you add this dimension to it, and notice how it changes the dynamics of the story. Why is Jesus silent? Well, his disciples are busy tugging at his sleeve, saying, "This is not good for us, not good for our reputation, not good for you, Lord, to be associating with a person like this." See how the story now becomes enriched as we add some of these other historical backgrounds. Anyway, for whatever reason, and this might be one of them, you've got the silence and you've got some dialogue that is now going to unfold. It seems that Jesus, for whatever reason, is testing this woman, both by his initial silence and by some pretty pushy dialogue here. Yet another reason why Jesus could well be pushing the boundaries here is that he disapproves of this woman for yet another reason. Her child has been afflicted by an unclean spirit. For a Jewish person, this simply means spiritual neglect. How come your child is spirit-possessed in this way? What have you been doing that enabled an unclean spirit to enter your child? That is a very typical, and I think because Jesus is fully human and fully Jewish, that could well be a reaction that Jesus had. And if he doesn't have it, I think he does, his disciples certainly do. It's another thing they're whispering in his ear. And her public persistence also is countercultural in the ways that I've just mentioned. But at the same time, as the story unfolds, Jesus clearly sees in this woman, and here's how I sum it up, that she's persistent, humble, brave, and witty as well. See, Jesus starts to talk about the children's bread, in effect, the privileged position that Jewish people have, to which she says, fine, that's just fine. I'm not asking for bread, I'm just asking for a few crumbs. It would just be a little thing for you to do, to offer a few crumbs in the form of healing my daughter. This is just a small thing for you to do. Pretty good, isn't it? It's pretty good as a kind of response. It seems if she's going along with him, as it were. So, Back to the cringe, because there's cringe in this story. That's the point about it being embarrassing. What's going on in this exchange between Jesus and the woman? Well, let me offer another dimension that I've hinted at, perhaps one simple explanation, because Jesus is a Jewish male and fully human. That's what we believe about Jesus. If so, then Jesus, because he's fully human, is on the one hand impressed by her smart humor, moved by her determined faith and humility. Perhaps he even learned something from the woman. That little Syrophoenician Lives Matter gloss that I showed you in one of the pieces of artwork hints at that. And of course, what we don't these days quite understand, but as we think ourselves into the story, a lot will depend upon the tone of voice and the meeting of eyes in the exchange. So that joke that I told you about the Jewish soldier and so on, it sounds pretty cruel and harsh and all the rest of it, but there was a twinkle in the rabbi's eye when he told it to us, because he's wanting to illustrate something about the Jewish psyche, and he does it by telling a story which, if you take it literally, is pretty horrible, but just by his tone of voice and the look in his eye, you know that he was trying to make a point that he wanted his fellow rabbis to grasp as they were debating the status of Job. Anyway, so what's going on in the story? Well, those dimensions there are going on. So here's a little piece of sort of naive art, which I think sort of gets it in a way. I know the child wasn't with the woman, but here's Jesus, his arms are folded. He's a bit worried by this, perhaps the spiritual neglect kind of thing. But he's got his head turned to, it's quite a nice piece of art, isn't it, in a kind of naive way. It captures something that a lot of the artwork about this story often doesn't get. Mind you, feminist interpreters keep going at it. I quite like this one. Food for the dogs. What do you think you're doing here, Jesus, in this story? Oh, there's another dimension. We can learn from each of these pieces of artwork. I'm sent only to Israel, says Jesus. And maybe this is the background of it as well. If I push this a little bit more, I think the look in Jesus' eye and the tone of their discussion. And this is a piece of artwork supposedly illustrating the story. There's the little dog, a puppy. There's a diminutive form of of dog used here. So it's clearly a puppy that Jesus has in mind, bit of bread on the table. So I could well imagine Jesus saying to the woman, you know, we Jews think that you dog-loving Greek speakers are actually no better than dogs. I'd soften it, but still keep it real by putting it like that. Look, you've come here begging me for help, but you know what we, he glances round at his disciples, you know what we think about you people. You know, we Jews think the dogs are unclean. You know, what do you mean by bringing dogs into this discussion? But she's well up to that move by Jesus. And I think Jesus knows that in advance. So rather than simply talk about the male Jewish Jesus without ignoring that, I think what we have here is a witty dialogue that develops a kind of domestic parable along the lines I've just tried to indicate. Jesus certainly knows the woman's not going to be silenced by this. In fact, the response of Jesus to a pushy, witty woman like this knows there will be more dialogue. Jesus is not speaking in a way that's going to close the conversation, but in fact, his tone of voice and the look in his eye and a glance round at his disciples knows there's more to come. And of course there is, from the woman and from him. She's not going to be silenced, deliberate or not, on Jesus' part. And that's, I'm a little uncertain about that. Jesus draws out a shrewd response that shows her persistence and sincerity. His response about dogs doesn't silence her. She's not so offended that she just turns on her heel and stalks off or just yells at him and abuses him. She can see something in the way Jesus is going in his response for her to keep going. And she does. And Jesus knows it, and Jesus rewards her. The story tells us then something about Jesus as human, about the woman, but it tells us also something about Jesus. There's a dimension in this story that actually stuns Jewish commentators. Jewish commentators like reading about the Gospels because, you know, Jewish setting and all the rest of it. And what Jewish academics will tell you is that one of the things that most intrigues them about this story is the way in which Jesus heals both this woman's son and the centurion's son or daughter and the centurion's son or slave. It's another story. Because what they say is, well, you know, back in the day and even today, a number of rabbis have the gift of healing. They have a gift of healing. But what they have to do is be present with the person they're healing. They've got to be able to lay their hands upon them and speak directly to them. Two stunning exceptions to this are Jesus healing the Syrophoenician mother's daughter and Jesus healing the son of the centurion. And Jewish academics will say to you, no rabbi is ever said to have had that gift. Jesus doesn't even have to be with the person to heal them. He heals at a distance. That's a remarkable claim that they notice there in the story. Secondly, Jesus breaks the traditional barriers between people and God. Even people, it seems, Jesus disapproves of. I don't mind saying that. That the story makes it clear Jesus disapproves of this woman in a number of ways. But his compassion and his sense of the universal love of God breaks through even his Jewish disapproval of the elements in this story. He overcomes the fear that his own disciples are demonstrating in the story and with the centurion whose son is healed. And maybe our fears as well. Can Jesus really speak to people who come from a different place to us? Really different place. I'm not just talking about Muslims or whatever, but I mean fellow Kiwis. Can Jesus break through to them? A story like this is meant to encourage us that he can, and there's certainly no reticence on the part of Jesus to reach out to people like this. So what the story tells us about Jesus, there's a strange anachronistic label, the Canaanite, in Matthew, and this allows Jesus to deconstruct or disown the mercy. You see, Old Testament, there's a merciless conquering of Canaanites. In this story, Jesus hears her ask for mercy and grants it immediately. No mercy to Canaanites in the Old Testament, to be honest. Jesus meets one and his heart goes out to her request for mercy. Jesus is not uncritical. His silence speaks, but he doesn't threaten the woman. And he attaches great importance to the humility and faith that she displays. So what the story says to us today, Jesus extends the boundaries of Israel and the people of God, and in fact embraces this woman now, it seems, as part of the people of God. Matthew makes a great point. In fact, it's emphatic in the Greek. I won't bore you with it. But these words, great and faith and you, all of them are emphatic as Matthew tells the story. Great, faith, you. Unlike his disciples and fellow Jews who don't have great faith, this woman does. In fact, this little phrase, great faith, especially by comparison with the disciples' lack of faith, this phrase, great faith, only occurs twice in all the Gospels. And it's both pagans, in both cases, it's pagans who display it. This pagan woman displays great faith that Jesus says, I've never seen anywhere else. And the centurion, you know, in Capernaum, whose son Jesus heals, Jesus says, here's great faith. And he explicitly says that I've not found anywhere in Israel. It's remarkable, isn't it? This is a remarkable story. Well worth thinking over. Well, let me stop there. I was going to show you, there's the centurion, and here's what Jesus does when he meets these people, talks and asks a question, kindness and help, refuses to threaten, praises some of the faith, uses them as examples, draws attention to himself, but you're smart enough to draw all those conclusions for yourself. So here's my summary. When we meet people who are different, let's engage like Jesus. Real dialogue with people, no fearing or threatening, respecting the faith and humility we find, not so naive as to say there's nothing wrong with you necessarily, confront when we need to, Jesus does, we can too, and point to Jesus himself. So here's my summary of the story. So Lizzie, have we got time just for a couple of questions? Or no, maybe we probably don't, do we? Just a couple of quick questions, because I know we've got communion. Or talk to me or email me or something. So any comments on the way in which I've tried to take us through this story? You can see that I'm fascinated with the story and have researched it in some detail. So comments or questions about the line I've taken with this story? From the back and then you, and then we'll probably start. Yep. Oh, yes. But it seems like she must have had a deeper understanding of who he was if she thought he could heal her daughter. Yes, yes. I've talked about this story with Maori people who say, it's obvious. When a Maori person meets someone with mana, they know it. I had a group of Maori people with me in Israel. What's all this talk about clothes? Nothing to do with clothes, Bob. You know mana when you meet it. So that's what they said. I was quite interested in that. They just knew this is someone, she knows this is someone who can help. I think that's possibly part of it. And a comment or question here.
Yeah, I think that was great to talk about the dialogue and the back and forth. And I think
yes.
For me, engaging in that dialogue, and I'm in the university, and having that sort of dialogue, the fear isn't so much from the people I'm having dialogue with, but what other Christians
might think.
And I think Christians can be really ungenerous.
Yes.
Having a genuine dialogue, learning from someone
else's
faith, and trying to share your faith in a way that makes sense to them.
Yes.
The biggest people who are going to criticise you, I think, are often Christians.
Hence my last bullet point there. Let's be orthodox, but let's have a generous orthodoxy. Because if Jesus is the measure of our orthodoxy, he's generous in this story, isn't he? This is a countercultural, lovely, generous display on the part of Jesus. That's a lovely way in which to end. Thank you, Lizzie.